I've been trying to say Christian ritual, what we do when we gather together in assemblies, has in common with all other human ritual making, or with at least one of the major themes of human ritual making, that it attempts to image a harmony, a wholeness, that makes it possible for us to believe in a cosmos, for us to imagine a cosmos, an ordered whole. And it does this by means of a certain poetics of the liturgy. One of the major components of which is the holding together of units in a tension, which tension contained within the liturgy then may be a synecdoche, a synecdoche for the larger harmony. So that, if, for example, if there is harmony between a single voice or a tension held between a single voice and a whole community, that little image may evoke in us the image of an ordered world. Having gone through an ordered hour, we imagine the possibility of ordered years, all ordered time, of an ordered life. Indeed, well, and the Christians, what is characteristic about Christian liturgy is that we do this around the memory of Jesus, that we thereby proclaim in liturgy itself that all things hold together in Him. And yesterday especially, I wanted to touch the point that that memory of Jesus is held most centrally for us in those privileged ritual central things of baptism and the Lord's Supper and the story or the word. And those are at the heart of our ritual, are indeed the ways, the primary ways in which these units get held in tension with each other around the memory of Jesus. In common with all other human ritual, Christian ritual has a sense of intention. We don't look at that very often in Lutheran circles, but I think it is true that it does have indeed a sense of intention. The ritual means to somehow try to accomplish the harmony which it images, to bring off the harmony which it images. Problem is, of course, as I came to the end last time, that it doesn't work. I said that yesterday and the day before, I wanted to dwell on what I called ritual harmony, upon the balance of opposites in the liturgy, upon ritual units held together in tension, because I think it is so important, because I think we have such a tremendous need for imaginatively richer liturgy, for a renewal in our circles of images in liturgy which aren't so flat, and which thereby allow us to imagine the possibility of indeed the redemption of more than we imagine sometimes in our liturgies, of God's grace cast over our darkness and our light. And I really do want to stress that. In some ways, I'd be tempted to go on and talk about that more today and in any occasion. But all of it is really prolegomena to the really important thing. All of that, while I would want to stress it and put all sorts of accent on it, it really is still only prolegomena to the most important thing, which is what I want to say today. Accent upon the necessity of doing ritual better and more clearly, more profoundly, of heightening the tensions, as I said, is still prolegomena to the much more important thing that it doesn't work. Now I say both those things, and I'll try to make that clear before I'm done. In some ways, finally today, I want to get to talk about the theology of the cross in a more profound sense. It's not really been the theology of the cross when I've just been talking about Jesus' cross as a symbol for all things held together, because I haven't yet faced up to the cross as execution and as failure. But more of that in a minute. The ritual doesn't work. We know that. We do Christmas every year. And it doesn't work. It does a little, of course. A little peace on earth. And you know, but we talk about, wouldn't it be nice if it could be Christmas all year? And we mean by that what we image indeed in the festival is what we long for human life to be like. At least in some sense, for human life to be so whole, generous, free, festive, warm. It is the midwinter protest, as I called it. But afterwards comes January. And there's that marvelous line in W.H. Auden's For the Time Being, where he talks about at the very end of it, oh, put the decorations away, you know. Come into the January blahs. It's a kind of month of low Sunday, as the Sunday after Easter is called, which is another evidence of the same phenomenon. That is, after the ritual is over and it's evident that it didn't work, it's a painful time, a kind of depressing time. My family tries very hard. We try very hard to... We're sort of gluttons for Christmas. And so we try very hard to stretch it out. So we keep the 12 days, not by any sort of great piety on our side, just because we get 12 days that way, you know, open presents every day and all that. But then comes 12th night and it's over, and we're into the much more empty season of Epiphany, where the light shines somehow, supposedly according to the proclamation, more broadly, more widely, but in a lot of ways a lot more invisibly as well. The ritual doesn't work. And it's not just Christmas or Easter and Low Sunday, as the Sunday after Easter is called. It is rituals in general. Ronald Grimes, who is who teaches at Waterloo, or I guess it's called Wilfrid Laurier University now in Waterloo, Ontario. It has an article forthcoming in Worship magazine, which, by the way, if you're interested in thinking about worship and ritual in this country, the probably the best journal, and increasingly ecumenical journal, is the journal published from St. John's Abbey in Collegeville. It's just called Worship, and is really interesting in the variety of things it has in it. He has an article forthcoming in which he says that it is a characteristic of liturgy that it falls short. But it doesn't get there. Ceremony, says Grimes. I used that a little bit yesterday. Ceremony, that's another matter. Ceremony has power and it uses it, like graduation ceremonies. But a characteristic of good liturgy is that it knows it doesn't arrive. That it is always sort of waiting, or that it images more power than it can achieve. That it aspires to more than it has power to produce. That's Grimes's line. Some of you maybe know the story of the thousand cranes in a Japanese story. The little girl who in Japan became very ill and was told by some spirit or other that if she made 1,000 cranes, you know, paper folding, she made 1,000 cranes, that when she reached 1,000 that she would be healed. Well, she made something like 750 and died. Well, every year in this town in Japan, there is a festival in honor of the girl, and they make cranes. And the children of the village make cranes and put them on a sort of little monument to her, and also send some of them floating down the river. It's really moving to me. Because it didn't work. The cranes didn't make it. She died. But they make cranes still. And the making of cranes still is an arrow pointing in the direction of the hope for life. Mircea Eliade, in his wonderful one of his most important studies, you know, Eliade teaches comparative religion in Chicago, and or has taught comparative religion in Chicago. Great, great, important American scholar of comparative religion. He's probably one of his basic studies was a study on shamanism. That shamans are sort of the witch doctors of the societies. That's what we call them pejoratively. They are the religious leaders and contact makers. Well, in Australian Aboriginal society, it's a shamanistic society. There's a little passage in Eliade's book that's stuck in my mind that's very interesting to me. When somebody is sick in Australian Aboriginal society, the shaman may sometimes come and try to pull the sick part out. And the shaman has some stones under his tongue or in his cheek. And he goes through his incantations and spiritually pulls the sickness out of the person, and meanwhile palms a stone out of his cheek, which then he pulls supposedly out of the person's body and shows it to them that he's gotten this thing out. Well, you know, obviously, shamans, as we've come to know, are kinds of tricksters. That's parcel of their baggage, is they do this kind of tricking. But Eliade reports that when a shaman is sick, he, of course, allows someone else to do it to him. And believes in it all the same. It doesn't work. But the ritual is done, sort of like the making of the cranes. I think that it's important for us to see that while we light lights against the darkness, it is an arrow in the direction of our hope, like Christmas, or like the thousand cranes, like the crane making that never reaches the thousand. But the darkness is not dispelled. We confess and are forgiven and sin yet again, and confess and are forgiven, and this thousand sins and this thousand repentances and this thousand sins again and this thousand repentances again, and on it goes. Our ritual is marked by arrows in the direction of what it hopes for. But that belongs essentially to good ritual. John, on Eucharist Sunday night, quoted a Jesuit friend of his, talked about his magic suit. He said he never quite felt the same about his alb again after it was called a magic suit. There's a sense in which that's right. It's a magic suit. What's helpful about calling it a magic suit? It helps us laugh at it a little. It is still a magic suit. And magic means to try to move toward laying hold of the power that we need. But calling it a magic suit enables us to laugh at it a little and realize that it doesn't quite get there. Thomas Merton, who was a pious Trappist monk, did liturgy every day of his life. I mean, kept his office and said his mass every day of his life. Hidden away in one of his cycles of poems has a wonderful little definition of liturgy, which is really important for those who make the cranes or do the liturgy to remember. Merton says, has this little line, and I counted a definition of liturgy. He says, animated clergy, and I think of himself living in that Trappist monastery where his brother clergy went through their rituals. Animated clergy storm the conceptual void in theodrama while deity groans. I think that's wonderful. Or Annie Dillard, some of you in the Northwest may know Annie Dillard, you should. She Pulitzer Prize writer, naturalist writer. The most recent book is set on an island in the Sound. Holy the Firm is the book, and in it she has this wonderful passage. She says, I think the high churches, the high Christian churches, the established Christian churches, approach God with a kind of unwarranted air of professionalism. Sometimes, I think, she says, that our liturgies are like scaffolding, whereover we scamper like so many Mohawks, unaware of our danger of falling. She says, sometimes I define liturgy as those words which we have successfully addressed to God without our getting killed, which I think is another wonderful definition of liturgy. Those kinds of things, those sorts of ways that we laugh at what we do, calling it magic suits, or the words we had successfully addressed to God without our getting killed, or animated clergy storming the conceptual void in theodrama while deity groans, or more beautifully perhaps, talking about the cranes, or about the shaman's stone. Those ways of our talking about the liturgy are ways of our pointing out that liturgy, at its healthiest, at its best, by the way, not just Christian liturgy, but all healthy human liturgy is not about the seizing and manipulation of power, but about the painful awareness of the community that we don't have the power, that we await for it, that we aspire to more than we can produce, that what we do in liturgy is like Moses on Nebo, looking into the promised land but not arriving. That we intend, but really never receive. The liturgy itself brings us to an emptiness, heightens our thirst. Sioux liturgy, Sioux ritual, is like that. One of the most moving of the seven rites of the Oglalas is what's called crying for a vision. And it's a way in which the people join with an individual in what's called lamenting. Lamenting is an essential part of liturgy. We've learned liturgy in the Christian church, largely one of the deepest roots of Christian liturgy are the Psalms. And at the heart of the Psalms are the laments. Crying for a vision. Crying for God's day. For God's peace. Awake, O God, why sleepest thou? Waiting for the power that we cannot affect. The liturgy can't be magic if what we mean by magic is ability to manipulate the power. It looks like magic, moves in the direction of magic, but it finally fails. And I want to say that's as it ought to be. Were it not that, it might be more like ceremony. More like our getting together and moving pressing all the right buttons and moving all the right movements so that we got the right result. No, liturgy moves us deeper into hunger and thirst for peace and for wholeness. If there is an image of harmony in the liturgy, it ought to awaken in us a thirst for harmony that is more than exists. There's that wonderful passage in John Updike's A Month of Sundays, where Updike has his fallen preacher, and this guy is really fallen, has his fallen preacher say, church has always borne the same relationship to God for me that billboards do to Coca-Cola. That is to say, it awakens the thirst without quenching it. I like that. It may be said somewhat cynically, but it seems to me that when I am open to what happens in church, it awakens my thirst without quenching it. Without finally, fully, wholly quenching it. It deepens my thirst. The danger of taking me seriously when I said we need to heighten the tensions in liturgy, lift the stakes, make it more clearly it's about shalom for all things, is that you deepen the thirst, that you make the liturgy a more painful thing, that you make yourself and your community more vulnerable to disappointment, to failure, to unconsoled suffering. And I want to say that that's indeed the way liturgy ought to move. Grimes talks about what he calls vacuum plenum, the full emptiness of the liturgy. The way Christian liturgy moves, like good human liturgy, moves toward fullness is by a kind of emptiness. Moses on Nebo. That belongs to good liturgy. Good liturgy needs a kind of healthy iconoclasm, lest we believe we're really bringing off the harmony that we image. Good liturgy needs, Christian liturgy needs a tension between icon and iconoclasm, between the image and breaking the image, lest we think we've brought it off with the image. See, the danger is, without that tension, were we to believe, I mean, were we simply to say that we image this harmony in Christian liturgy, then it would seem as if what Christian liturgy were about were no longing or hoping or protest, but simply celebrating the status quo, saying everything as it is wonderful. This is the best of all possible worlds. Bringing everything again into visible harmony in the liturgy, once again coming to believe that this is an ordered cosmos. We don't believe that. It is not a finally ordered cosmos. It is a cosmos longing, says St. Paul. Longing, groaning indeed. With the groaning at its heart, which is the very groaning of the Spirit of God, toward the day of God, the day of redemption, of salvation. And that groaning, that waiting, needs to come to expression in liturgy. That was what was so dangerous in the 60s when we talked about liturgy as celebration of life. Without introducing into it elements of groaning. Some so-called contemporary liturgy currently in our time runs that danger. As if sort of celebrating harmony and joy now. It winds up communicating the idea that it is a blessing on the status quo without being filled with urgent longing. As if our celebration as if our celebration of harmony were enough. As if it were all whole and well. No, liturgy inevitably is reaching higher than we can reach. And that inevitably means that our liturgy is going to be marked by stumbling. By awkwardness. And that awkwardness we need to look at. I don't mean to say that by means of a kind of excuse. I want to say everything I've said to start with. You know, heighten the tension. Beautiful gesture. Beautiful image. Powerful symbol. Those are things we need to move more and more toward. But we fool ourselves if we think we will leave awkwardness behind. Awkwardness, little reminder that the liturgy is only 150 cranes, 10 cranes, a few cranes down the road toward life. I think one of the things that happens in good ritual initiation, to call it by its anthropological term, in confirmation, to call it by its Lutheran term, in the process of growing into and being a participant in the rituals, is to see the symbols both in their power and also in their simplicity, their commonness. Boys who finally become dancers in Hopi Indian villages see the masks for the first time in the Kiva, and they see that their masks, what they've been frightened about with, these Kachina dancers that they've been frightened by all through their early life, they discover are masks that some members of the community are wearing. Now it's their turn. They wear them too. They learn at once a certain skepticism about the symbols. And also, they learn a certain beyond the skepticism, they learn what Paul Ricoeur calls a second naivete. That is, the possibility to hold themselves in the power of the symbols even though they know that they're just masks. That they're just a few cranes down the road. That's an important thing to learn in learning about the liturgy. Learn how to laugh at it and still love it. Learn to live in that kind of tension that Thomas Merton keeps, you know, between doing his office and talking about animated clergy. Learn how to put on the alb and call it a magic suit at the same time. I'm a Lutheran, I tell people sometimes, because Lutherans, it seems to me, are really try to live in that tension. I say it's the tension between Amos and Leviticus. And the one hand, Leviticus, filled with all those wonderful... Read Leviticus sometimes. The ritual for the cleansing of a leper. It's beautiful. All the blood dipping and oil pouring and grain scattering. It's a beautiful thing in Leviticus 14, I think. But also Amos. I despise your solemn assemblies. I take no pleasure in your burnt offering. They're held together in the covers of the same book. How to hold them together in the same communal life. Seems to me Christian ritual initiation needs to introduce us into that tension. There's an even deeper tension. The tension of the liturgy is to hold all kinds of disparates together, but finally the ritual harmony itself needs to be held in tension with its own failure. So that in fact, the liturgy doesn't just become a machine for blessing the status quo, for saying all this world is held together in harmony, but so indeed it is. It allows us to question old harmonies and earnestly cry out for a harmony, a shalom, that is richer and deeper and able to save more than we can image in our liturgies or than we can imagine. We need to see the symbols of liturgies at once as powerful symbols, holding ourselves before them, holding ourselves under their spell. And at the same time, we need to see them as broken, as Paul Tillich calls them. Broken symbols. Know that they're just symbols. Both things. It is just bread. It is also the very gift of God. Both. Held together. That's important. Religion is misused when it seems to be saying that it in its rituals can show us the meaning of everything. For if the meaning of the whole is already given, and all we do in our rituals is enact the meaning of the whole, then this is an awful world. If there were the slightest hint of unconsoled suffering in this world, of senseless suffering, then I guess I'd have to agree that such a religion that supposedly celebrates the meaning of everything would be the religion of what Ingmar Bergman calls a spider god. No. Christian religion waits for the meaning of the whole. Waits yet for the meaning of all things. And waits thereby also in its liturgy, allowing its liturgy to be open, open-ended, an open circle, lest its liturgy be a cult as celebration of this status quo, because there's more than just a hint of unconsoled suffering in the world, and of meaningless pain. Because this is a world of oppression and failure and loss. Our liturgies wait for God's day. So, Gordy Dahl in his book about leisure talks about what he calls the grave merry man. I love that. The grave merry man is the one who in all human mirth knows the sentiment of insufficiency. Well, I like to talk about the grave Mary liturgist, then, who in all human ritual knows the sentiment of insufficiency. Roger Granger, in a book called The Language of the Rite, published by Longmans in England, recent book, has this quote that I like. Out of the obvious contrivance, the purposeful limitations of the rite, comes insight into the truth about ourselves, that we can only attain true selfhood, true being, by embracing contingent being in all awareness of its contingency. Now, that's a little abstract, but what it means to me is that healthy liturgy, and that means generally human liturgy, has in its heart a bit of mourning, a bit of lament, and a lament about itself, about its own inability, an awareness of itself as waiting, as vacuum plenum, as full emptiness, as not being able to be there, as being some cranes on the road, and that good liturgy has us embrace that as a way of life. Now, the wonderful thing is the danger of that kind of talk is that you come back and say, you say to that, how do you say that and avoid thinking that God is gone altogether? How do I stand in the spell of the symbols, move to what Ricoeur calls second naivete? Ricoeur, in his wonderful book, The Symbolism of Evil, talks about first naivete is when the symbols sort of function for you unbrokenly. Then you move through a critical phase when you learn they're just masks. Second naivete is when you let the masks dance again. Image your own hopes for life. How do I let that second naivete function? Or to put it more directly, what does God have to do with the liturgy? There's one way in which you could answer that question by saying nothing at all. Deity groans. Liturgy is our image of hope, our billboards, awakening thirst. But, I always love this but. But, while human ritual generally, when it is healthy, needs to know its failure, Christian liturgy sets that failure side by side with the deepest thing we can say about God. And that is with the cross, with the crucified. What does God have to do with the liturgy? He waits with us. That all of our waiting is gathered into his Son. The risen one is wounded still. I always think that's one wonderful thing. The risen one is wounded still, and I, he says in John's Gospel, when I am lifted up, meaning the cross, will draw all to myself. The risen one is wounded still, and our liturgy, which is itself also essentially failure, celebrates at its deepest heart the crucified, and thereby stands with him before the face of God, waiting for the day of full and open manifestation. You have died, says St. Paul, and your life is hid with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also shall appear with him in glory. This is, our liturgy is the liturgy of the time in between. Our liturgy is the liturgy of the time in the midst of our death while yet we confidently wait. Religion is misused, I said, when it seems to image an answer to the question about what is the nature of the harmony of all things currently. In such religion, God appears as the one who gives the guarantee of a certain way of life, which is the way that is then in harmony with all things. And the cult is a way in which one generates in the community, once again, belief in the myth of the harmony of all things and willingness to walk in that way of life. But in the scripture, God appears in order to vindicate the poor, to stand with the oppressed. The God of the scriptures is the God of the future. Meaning waits for the world until all oppression is answered. The what we can say about God is what we can say about the crucified most deeply, most profoundly. Our liturgy is liturgy around God, because it is liturgy around the crucified. And that is liturgy not around some cultic act. Our redemption is not another liturgy. Our liturgies point outside of themselves to an event that was not a liturgy, but an execution, and of a man who was not a priest. We call him priest and great high priest, but we do it metaphorically. He wasn't a priest. He was a layman. He wasn't Kohen. And that's why he's called priest after the order of Melchizedek. It's a metaphor for calling an executed man, the very way we come into contact with God. The God we come into contact with is the God who will be God of all this world and whose shalom is for all. That means, then, that our liturgy invites us into waiting, into openness to unconsoled suffering, into solidarity with those who wait for God's day. That insofar as our liturgy brings us again and again face to face with the cross, it brings us into contact with what Johannes Metz calls the dangerous memory of the cross. For us to remember the cross again and again and again is for us to set at the heart of our ritual the story of one who was vanquished. That's a revolutionary act. It's going to be subversive, inevitably. The way ceremonies write history is about those who succeed, about those who get power. Our liturgy means to be finally around the vanquished, and with him, all the vanquished of the world. So our prayers inevitably need to be prayers for hopeless cases. And if our liturgy is folding of cranes up to a count of 7 or 8 or 150 or something, if our liturgy is folding of cranes, it is not just whistling in the dark, because at the heart of our folding of the cranes, Jesus our Lord gathers our hopes into an even greater hope and gathers us in solidarity with all those who cry out with their very lives. Christian liturgy, done as we would do it by circles of people who are really relatively well off in the history of the world, needs to be a way in which we bring to expression, we bring to voice what is expressed elsewhere in the world, not by voice, but by bodies that suffer. We bring to voice the earnest prayer, "Thy kingdom come." And we do it with our Lord, with him, gathered with him, with the one who is risen, but wounded still. And what his resurrection means is that we trust that indeed this God will reign, that what God has done already will become evident and manifest. That we encounter the meaning of the cross as not the meaning of a dead end, but the meaning of grace and hope. But it waits yet, waits still. So, all the symbolic units of the liturgy brought into tension, to image a harmony, are brought around Christ. So that the harmony that we image, the hope for shalom for all things, is indeed in the blood of the cross. And it is indeed hope, so that all the waiting of the liturgy, all the openness, the powerlessness of the liturgy, waits with the crucified Lord Jesus toward the day of God. And liturgy at once awakens our imagination and hope for universal harmony and deepens our hunger for it. I think then Updike's quote is right and a useful one for us. Okay, what implications flow out of that? But what's that mean for liturgy to say that? To talk that say the liturgical failure is part, the deep part of liturgy. I've said, and I want to say again, I don't mean by that that that's an excuse for doing things sloppily. On the contrary, you fold the crane as beautifully as you can. I mean, the beautiful crane that it can indeed awaken with those beautiful folded cranes, awaken profoundly the image of the hope for life. It's dangerous to do that because you bring yourself out of a flat and even life. You bring yourself into hunger and thirst. You bring yourself into solidarity with all those people in the world who do indeed from their sick beds or from their sick countries or from their sick central cities long for life, capital L. But that's what you do. You fold the crane as beautifully as you can, but you know that you don't make many of them. And not nearly enough. You try to stand between Amos and Leviticus. You do the ceremony beautifully, and you laugh a little at it. The problem with us in liturgy in our country is that we've resolved that tension again, especially in Lutheran circles. Either we've said, look, that's just magic, I'm not going to mess around with that, and we've let it go entirely, or we've done it and we've thought we've been really earnest and serious about it. We really thought it was gonna work. We've done what, you know, the chancel prancing, as we called it, as if somehow chancel prancing would put the world in order. We've done it indeed out of our own obsessive compulsive kind of ideas that sort of you order that world. And I've known, and knowing myself, the obsessive compulsive pastor who wants to order his world and his life by ordering his liturgy. No, you hold yourself between Amos and Leviticus. You know the poetics of the liturgy, but you know also that the poetry deepens the thirst. What does that mean then, concretely? It means everything, for example, about the way power is used in the liturgy. A lot of our liturgies look a lot more like ceremonies than they do about like liturgy that waits. Power is there. As soon as you start using powerful symbols, there's a powerful evocation there. Power is there. I like to talk, for example, to organists and talk about the power the organist has. I really do. That power in that music, the symbols of the music, to put things together and to overwhelm people. But it seems to me that organists and church musicians generally need to know both about power and also about the restraint of power. You know, full organ is fine sometimes, but you don't just constantly overwhelm people so that they are dwarfed. So that, in fact, your power controls the thing. That's something to say to pastors. That's why I like to talk about hospitality. a lot of times young pastors and other people involved in leadership of liturgy in our time fly from power altogether. They fear it, and so they run from it. Most of our churches are made in such a way you don't even see the pastor. Sort of hides behind a wall or something during the liturgy. Then it's not really even a human meeting, and the pastor is afraid of presiding, lest he be too powerful. That's not the way. You've got to know that you're going to run the danger, but at the same time, find a way to restrain your power so there's room for the other people. It has to do with the power-laden yielding of power. Power gets exercised in Christian liturgy by yielding place, by making room, by breaking power. And we don't solve that problem by pretending that there's no power there, because there is. As soon as you start having images of life, it's a powerful time. I said yesterday in answer to a question about the an Assembly of God church that one of the things that's worried me most about charismatic assemblies that I've seen is unbroken power. The power of controlling people without it being broken. It means, this kind of talk about the liturgy means that the liturgy needs to be open to prayer for suffering. Open to unconsoled suffering. That's really important. I really do worry about the fact when our prayers for the church get expressed and all we do is pray for ourselves and pray easy prayers. Pray ones that aren't dead-end situations, dead-end prayers. Our liturgy needs to be, precisely because it is the cross at the center, needs to be open to unconsoled suffering. We need a catechesis into the liturgy, a teaching in the liturgy that allow us to show the symbols as masks and yet allow us also to move toward a second naivete. The way Paul Tillich expresses this balance, you know, is to say there needs to be a balance between Catholic substance and Protestant principle. And Tillich calls us to both, Catholic substance, Protestant principle. And I really buy that. But the heart of what I mean to say is that Jesus Christ needs to be at the heart of our liturgy. Not just an ideology about how the embracing of waiting will move us toward life or the embracing of suffering is the way toward hope, but that Christ's cross is our hope. Christ's wounds, the way toward God's future. And the wounds of Christ in the font and in the meal, and in the word, need to be at the heart of our non-triumphal waiting, of all of our images of harmony gathered in hope for his day. So that our liturgy is real beseeching, but because of him, beseeching with confidence. Another implication is that the liturgy needs to be marked by what Turian calls the crisis of the offertory. All liturgy has a sense of offering. We bring our stuff, our bread, our wine, our water, our beautiful work, our preparation of the sermon, our music, as if it would create a harmony. But there is a crisis, and we realize it won't get there. And we sing, and we've sung in Lutheran liturgy, I think really wonderfully, with insight, the sacrifices of God are a broken spirit. A broken and a contrite heart, O God, thou wilt not despise. But somehow, in our stuff, the stuff of this world, he gives us the wounds of his Son. Sharing our broken situation, gathering it deeper than we thought we could go into pain, and making it yet the grounds in his Son, the grounds of hope. Well, there's lots more implications to draw, but that's enough time for today. And I guess I want to try to come back to all this and sum up what I've been trying to say today by terms of a little story that I'll use on Saturday. On Friday, we'll talk about the Lutheran Book of Worship, and tomorrow we'll have a break. So thank you very much.